in gravity, a black hole has a horizon, and we associate with a black hole an entropy, which we calculate as a quarter times the horizon. But gravity itself doesn't tell us what are the microstates responsible for this entropy. So luckily, in string theory, we can model the black hole as a set of brains. And for that set of brains, we can calculate the number of microstates. And then we can try to match if that number of microstates match what we expect from the gravity side. And it's one of the great successes of string theory that this works. And it works for certain supersymmetric and near supersymmetric black holes. Okay, so when you identify the black hole and you've tried to find which brains to model it by, then of course, well, the chances of the black hole will tell you something about which brains to use in your model. So you match the gauge charges to the type of brain that has to be the same on both sides. You also match something like what kind of angular momentum the black hole has. The question is now, if your black hole is not uniquely specified for these conserved charges, then how do you know in string theory which black hole you're calculating the entropy for? So what is interesting for us is that black rings, there are supersymmetric black rings, which are not uniquely specified by their conserved charges. And then the question is, how do you deal with this non-uniqueness when you try to model a black hole? One question is, of course, what kind of brain system do you need in order to model the black ring? So, what's the brain system that you use? And how do you deal with the non-uniqueness? So what I'll try to do in this talk is to give an overview of the progress in black rings over the past year or so, starting with supersymmetric black rings, their construction, and their properties. And then I'll try to emphasize some of the aspects that are still open questions and which are interesting that provide new features in the context of black holes and string theory. There are a couple of questions to also take into account as part of the motivation. And then now that we've seen that there's non-uniqueness for black holes in higher dimensions, then there's some obvious questions to ask. What black holes exist in higher dimensions? And how much non-uniqueness can you have? And there's another interesting aspect is if you take the supersymmetric black holes and then add some energy, you get a non-supersymmetric black hole. And that has an entropy and it has an interesting first law which provides new features to black hole first laws. That's something we heard Keith talk about a couple of weeks back. So, new first law. So the main point of this is just that there's a lot to learn about black holes in higher dimensions still. Well, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to outline the simplest construction of supersymmetric black rings. So we work in a five-dimensional model with an action. So in this part here, I'm going to be completely schematic. So all the constants will, well, no constants will be correct. But it's just it's only to sketch how the construction works and what the result is. So we work with an action, which is dimensional. And then there's a Chern-Simons term. So this is Einstein natural theory with a Chern-Simons term. So this theory was analyzed by Harvey and collaborators at Queen Mary. And what they looked for was solutions to the equation of motionless action, solutions that are supersymmetric. So based on the assumption of supersymmetry, you actually get to know a lot about quantum solutions. First of all, if you have supersymmetry, then you know that there's going to be a non-space-like equation for the geometry. In our case, we're going to be interested in the case where there's a time-like Killing vector. So that means that if there's a time-like Killing vector, you can write the metric in this form here. So B here, well, T is the coordinate associated with the time-like Killing direction. This space here, B, is a four-dimensional base space, which in our case is just going to be flat space, but in fact, supersymmetry will tell you that this base space always has to be a hyperkähler. Well, the metric on this space has to be hyperkähler. So furthermore, there are two more ingredients. There are two scalar functions, F, and there's a one-form omega on the base space. So omega is a one-form on B. So
since we had a time-like Killing vector, nothing in this metric will depend on time, on the time coordinate C. So from this one-form omega, we can pick out the self-dual part and call it G plus. So this is the Hochstar on the base space. And we've included a factor of this scalar function F just for convenience. So this is just handy notation, because supersymmetry will also give us that the field strength of the gauge field can be written in the following form. Like that. So just by assuming supersymmetry, you have the form of the metric, like that, and you know the field strength of the gauge field. Okay. But you also want things to be solutions to the equations of motion. So one thing you must impose is the Bianchi identity for the gauge field. And if you do that for this gauge field, you see that G plus has to be a closed form. The equation of motion for the gauge field will give that if you take the Laplacian on the base space here and act on F inverse, then that's the same as G plus squared. So G plus, you take the components and then you contract them. You contract with the metric on the base space. So that's the second condition. Now it turns out, and this was shown by Harvey and the group at Queen Mary, that if you have these two conditions satisfied, then you're also guaranteed, well, along with supersymmetry, that the Einstein's equations are going to be solved. So now you're essentially done. The strategy for finding a solution is that you pick a base space, then you make an ansatz for the omega 1 form, construct G plus and impose that G plus is a closed form, then solve this equation for F, plug back in and solve for omega, and then you know everything. You have the gauge field and you have the metric. And that's essentially what we do. What you'll generally find is that solving this equation, well, if the right-hand side here is 0, then f inverse is going to be a harmonic function on the base space. So typically, you'll have something, you'll have f to be on the form of, well, I've included a constant 1. That's just in order for the solution to be asymptotically flat. Then there's a harmonic piece. And then if this right-hand side is non-vanishing, then you'll have a non-harmonic piece too. So when you start with this theory, before looking for solutions, you might ask what solutions are possible in general. So once again, you apply Harvey. And well, in this case, it's just you. So Harvey shows that if you assume asymptotic flatness, then you can ask, what kind of black holes can you have? What are the black holes geometry you can have? And the horizon topologies that are possible are the following three. So that is a free torus, or a circle times a two sphere, or a three sphere that is possibly squashed. You can then, well, Harvey went on and he showed that the only black hole with this kind of near horizon geometry, is the BMPV black hole. So this is a black hole with an S3, topologically an S3 horizon. It has two angular momenta, so there are two independent planes in 5D. And it has the property that the magnitudes of the angular momenta must be equal in the two planes. Well, the black rings that we found fall in this class, of course. That's why they're black rings. And I can do it over here. Let me describe what they are. So the horizons are a circle times a two sphere. So the circle is going around here. And if you take a cross section like that, then this will be a two-sphere. They have angle momenta in both planes. So one is in the plane in which the S1 lies. And then there's an angle momentum that you can think of being associated with a two-sphere. It's the orthogonal plane to the other plane. And that gives a second angle momentum. So these angle momenta have the properties that J1 is always greater than or equal to J2. In the limit where these two become equal, you actually end up with a BMPV black hole. So that means, well, in terms of non-uniqueness that we talked about in the beginning, there's no overlap between the BMPV and the supersymmetric black ring, because they're always going to have asymptotic different angle momenta. Okay, so this construction gives you black rings in five-dimensional minimal supergravity. I should mention that these solutions, in terms of minimal supergravity, the mass is fixed in terms of the charge of the black hole, so the charge under this gauge field in the theory. And this is just the BPS condition. This holds for both of them, of course. But the black ring also has another kind of charge, which is non-conserved. So this comes about because you can take a two-sphere and link it with a ring, and then compute the flux through that two-sphere. So if I take this away, so I imagine that I take here a two-sphere that links only once with a black ring, and then I compute the flux through that two-sphere, and that'll give me a charge, little q, which is called the dipole charge. So it's a non-conserved charge because, well, one way to think about it is that you have a brain that wraps around the direction here. But since the cycle, the S1 of the black ring is contractible, the brain could just collapse and go away, so you can lose that charge. So this is one of the new features of black holes in higher dimensions. And it's also the feature that feeds into the new type of first law that you see for black rings. Not in the case of supersymmetric black rings, but the non-supersymmetric ones. Yeah.
So this T3 option, it's still completely open whether there exists solutions?
I don't think there are any results that exclude their existence, but nobody has found any solutions.
So not known, but they don't know.
I think it's very unlikely.
Yeah. But there are no results excluding their existence. No. Okay. So now we have solutions of minimal supergravity. But we want to associate them with brains, try to understand them better in a string theory setup. So one can generalize these solutions to five-dimensional supergravity, but with more gauge fields. So those gauge fields come from various different fields that you have in higher dimensional theory. For instance, you can think of this as arising from 11-dimensional supergravity. And from that, you can identify which brains go into the system. So let me show how this comes about. So you take 11-dimensional theory and reduce it on a 6-torus to get down to the 5-dimensional theory. The setup is the following. I'll just use the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 for the directions on the torus. And then psi here denotes the S1 of the black ring. So the setup is to take 3 M2 brains and then place them on the torus orthogonally. So they sit like this. And these will correspond to the net charges of the black ring. You also have to put something in for dipole charges. And for that, you use M5 brains. Now, they're dipoles because one of the directions that they all wrap is this S1 direction of the ring. And this is why they're not conserved, because they could just collapse down from this contractible S1. Well, on the 6-torus, they just sit overlap pairwise over 2 directions, like that. Okay. So I'll call these capital Qs, and the other ones just small Qs. So the solution I described here is what you get if you take all the QIs to be equal to some Q. So you take all equal charges, or the same number of M2 brains wrapping each of these different cycles. And you take all the dipole charges to be the same too. Then the theory truncates down to this theory here, where there's only one gauge field. So the five-dimensional theory. And the solution you obtain is just the one I described here for the black ring. So there were two other groups who, at the same time, wrote papers about this solution, the generalization. One is by Bina and Warner. And one thing they tried to do was to take an arbitrary cross-section for this. Instead of having a round circle, they tried to take an arbitrary cross-section and see what happens. But Gary and Harvey have shown that that does not result in a black hole, in the sense that the horizon is no longer regular if you don't have a round cross-section. So what I'm going to talk about in this talk only is the case where you have a round cross-section for the black ring. So the other paper that came out was by Gondlet and Gutowski. And they added a new feature also. Well, there are two papers. And in those papers, they constructed not just one black ring, but concentric black rings. So they have to be rings around the same point, but they can be in different planes. So okay. So the M-theory picture of the charges of black rings is handy for some cases, but in other cases, it's also useful to reduce M-theory down to type 2A and then dualize the system to type 2B so that the net charges become charges of D1, D5, and momentum. So the momentum runs along the intersection of the D1 and D5. And the dipole charges become D1, let me just call it capital, D1, D5, and a Kaluza-Klein monopole. So in the case of the BMPV black hole, when people first tried to understand the entropy microscopically from the brain system, this is typically the brain system. Well, this is the duality frame that one uses to calculate the entropy. Okay, so yes, I'm going to say something about the properties of the rings. In the case where you have, you can choose freely the three charges and the dipoles. In that case, and it's a circular cross-section too. In that case, what we find is a 7-parameter family of solutions. Now, if you think of the conserved charges, then of course the M2 brains, the number of M2 brains you have, are going to be conserved charges. So the Qs, Q1, Q2, and Q3 are conserved charges. And so are the two angular momenta that you measure at infinity. So that gives you 5 conserved charges. So this, of course, leaves a 2-parameter, a 2-fold continuous non-uniqueness of black rings. So what is responsible for the non-uniqueness? Well, what is responsible is that you can change the dipole charges while still keeping fixed the charges measured at infinity. The 5 conserved charges. But they're only a 2-fold non-uniqueness. And that's because, we only have 7 parameters, and it means that one dipole is also always going to be fixed in terms of the conserved charges and the other dipoles. Now, continuous is classically. In the classical theory, we can fix the 5 parameters and then just vary 2 of the dipoles. But once you quantize the theory, or when you think of it as charges arising from brains, then both the capital Qs and the little Qs are going to be quantized in terms of the number of brains that goes into the system. So that means that, of course, the non-uniqueness becomes discrete. And what one can show is also that not necessarily the dipole charges are bounded from above by the net charges. So that means that not only the non-uniqueness becomes discrete, but it also becomes finite. Of course.
You don't see that bound in the continuous case?
Oh, you see that the bound is still there. The bound is essentially like this, that this has to be positive. But you still have an infinite non-uniqueness because you can vary the parameter continuously. So you get a discrete, finite non-uniqueness in string theory. Of course, this, even if it's a finite non-uniqueness, it can still be very big because you have a large number of brains going into the system. So what we want to ask is if we can understand microscopically what these black rings are. So what is the brain system we have to look at? And one part of motivation is from earlier work, we noticed that black rings, non-extremal black rings with 2 charges and just 1 dipole, had an extremal limit where they precisely became a solution of a brain object that is the supertube. So what you want to put in here is some kind of supertube. Now, since this has 3 charges, and three dipoles. This should have three charges and three dipoles. So the goal is to construct some, well, in a world volume description, let me say this is a world volume description, a supertube object with three charges and three dipoles. So I should say that this is, the first supertube was with two charges and one dipole by Mateos and Townsend. Well, so there's been work by Bena and Krauss, and this is even before supersymmetric black rings were found. So what they did was to work not in either of those frames, but in a frame that is T-dual to this type 2 frame. And there they work with the world volume theory of a D6 frame. And, well, there are two other charges, D0. No, well, this is one of the dipole charges, I should say. So they work with the world volume of a D6 frame. But in that duality frame, one of the other dipoles is going to be an NS5 frame. And there's no way of describing an NS5 brain inside the D6 brain. So what this gives them is a free charge two-dipole supertube. Another feature is that the black rings we find, the gravity solutions that we find, have these two angular momenta. And you can't get rid of one of them. You need to have both of them to have a non-zero horizon area. But the supertube descriptions here have the second angle momentum, the one associated with the S2, has that to be zero. So it simply doesn't capture all the physics of the supergravity solutions. So that's another approach. Which was in the second paper here. And that involves the description of black rings in M-theory. So you circumvent the problem of not being able to describe an NS5 brain in a D6 brain by lifting the solutions up to M-theory. And then you use the M5 brain world volume theory instead. So this is an M-theory approach. And that captures all three charges and all three dipoles. But again, we're missing the second angle momentum. So one of the open problems in black ring physics is whether or not it's possible to construct a world volume description that captures all the features of the gravity solutions. Yeah. Yep.
Doesn't the fact that you have entropy imply that you need to somehow quantize this type of group? Say quantizing in the case where you have the simple supertube.
That's possible, but well, so one thing that you can do is, I mean, okay, it doesn't answer the question. One thing you can do is the two charge one dipole case. You can model the supersymmetric object, but in that case, there's no horizon. So that might be your point. That's why you can match them. The question is, if you know what that world volume theory is, then if you add a little bit of energy, can you then use that to describe a near supersymmetric two-charge object? And that hasn't been worked out either. It hasn't been possible to match the entropies of those objects. Now, for the three-charge case, you do have the horizon. But there's another aspect, which is if you take one of these dipoles to zero, then the horizon, the solution becomes singular. The horizon shrinks to zero. Okay, so you should imagine that you're going to have some free charge two-dipole supertube that captures all the features, but still this one doesn't. It doesn't have the second angle momentum, which this one does, even if you set one dipole to zero. So, well, there are also another slight mismatch that I can mention later. So. It might be a problem that there's a horizon and to get the full match, but even in the case where there isn't, you can't get a full match of the solutions.
If
there enough known about this M35 brain to, I mean, do you need to assume like just one 5 brain?
Yes, you can deal with just one. So the idea is that you describe, just using one, the world volume of one 5 brain, you can picture them, you can get them all. So essentially the idea is that you can have two orthogonal brains, and you can picture, well, you can model them by just one world volume theory, which has this shape. In some cases, you can then also resolve the intersection and get something like that, so it's not singular anymore.
But those charges would have to be one, and not sort of big.
That's true, but that's always the way it is when you do the world volume description, unless you incorporate some kind of non-commutative features, which hasn't been tried here. But yeah, I mean, that could be fun to try. It just hasn't been done. Okay, so what about the horizon area? Well, if you write down what it is in terms of the charges, you find the following. Okay, so you get a formula that looks like this from the gravity side. So, the tilted Qs are the capital Qs minus products of the dipole charges. And then you just permute the indices to get the other ones. So one thing to notice from this is that even if you fix all the conserved charges, the horizon area is going to vary with the dipole charges. So that means that the horizon area it depends explicitly on the non-conserved charges. So can you compute the entropy microscopically? So there are two results on this. First one is Bena and Krauss. So one thing they tried was to say, we make a split of the system. One part of the system we describe as a BMPV type black hole. So people know how to do these type of entropy calculations for the BMPV black hole. So they split it into this part where they know how to do the calculation, and then a part that takes into account the different properties of black rings compared to BMPV, which is then a supertube part. But what goes in is that they have to make what they call an empirical assumption about how to make this split. And if they make that assumption, they can get a match to this formula. But this split is still unexplained. It hasn't been tested if it makes sense in other connections. So another approach is by four people. The idea here is to use that one knows how to calculate the entropy of a four-dimensional black hole in the case where you take it to be a solution in 11 dimensions, but you split those 11 dimensions into, well, the 4D part and a circle that you compactify on, and then some Calabi-Yau space. In our case, this would just be a 6 torus. So they do this splitting. Well, this is what you do for the 4D black hole, and then you can compute the entropy. So what they say is, well, this circle here will just take the circle around the black ring. So this is what I call the psi direction up here. So instead of having something that is compactified on a circle, you have something which is really lives in five-dimensional space, but where this circle is now the contractible circle of the black ring. And then they can do the calculation and again match to this formula here. So one thing that is a big mysterium in both type of calculations is the role of the second angle momentum. So this model here where you do the split doesn't really capture the physics of this J5. On the other hand, here, the four-dimensional black hole doesn't have any angular momentum. So when you apply that calculation in the 5D black ring, you're sort of pretending that you don't have this angular momentum either. It doesn't show up explicitly. So in both cases, the second angular momentum is a little mysterious. And it would be nice to understand better why. Well, one question is, why do these calculations actually, I mean, why do they work? And how? Why do they both work? Because they're very different.
So that's the same angular momentum which is not showing up in these super tube descriptions.
Well, yes, so there's a slight difference. In this case here, you need, one of the ingredients is that there's a momentum along that circle. In this approach here, you pick that momentum to be J1, which is pretty intuitive because that is the angular momentum that goes around in that direction. But in this approach here, the angular momentum of the S1 will be the difference in the two angular momenta, at least in one version of the argument. You can also, the formula that, well, this result here is based on a paper by Maldacena, Strominger, and Witten. And you can also try to take their formula, use a slightly different, actually you use something that looks like these charges instead of the capital Qs, and then you use the difference in moment, in angle momenta as the momentum going around. And then you can also reproduce this formula. So that's also a little mysterious. But that approach is a bit similar to another calculation by Benin Cross. Oops. So an aspect that really hasn't been explored much at all is the ADS CFT aspects of black rings. So what we'll do here is focus on the case where we're in type 2B. And the charges of the black ring, or the black hole, is d1, d5, and momentum. So to study ADS CFT, you need to take the decoupling limit of the system. So that's the limit where you take alpha prime to go to 0, while keeping the number of brains and the string coupling and other things like that fixed. The size of the circle, you go the S1, things like that, you keep fixed. So just a comparison, if you do something like this for BMPV, what you find is that everywhere locally, you find a structure which is ADS3 times an S3 times a T4. So this is a 10-dimensional type 2B picture. So that means that when you do the entropy calculation of BMPV, you can essentially use the ADS structure, just like that. But if you do this for a black ring, what you find is that in general, you just don't have this simple product structure at all. You find some more complicated geometry. And, well, if we imagine that we have a radial coordinate, and we can take a limit of this geometry that we find in the decoupling limit, we take a limit where this goes to infinity, so that means we enter the asymptotic region. Then, in this asymptotic region, we do recover an ADS3 times an S3. The T4 is just going along. One can also find is that the scale of, the radius of ADS3 and the 3-sphere are the same here. And it's set by the charges of the two net charges of the number of D5 brains and D1 brains. This is the similar story as you find for BMPV. Now, as you go just a little bit away from this asymptotic region, this product structure goes away completely. I mean, you still, this product structure part, you still have the T4 always as a product in the solution. But as you come in and you approach the near horizon region, there's again an ADS3 times S3 structure. But now the S3 is modded out by a discrete group, Cn. And this n here is the number of Kaluza-Klein monopoles. So where was this? Well, the d1, d5, and momentum were the net charges of the system. And the dipole charges in this frame were d1, d5, and a Kaluza-Klein monopole. So this feeds into changing the shape, to changing what the geometry is here. Now in this limit here, the radius of the S3 and the radius of the ADS3 are again the same. But it's now set not by the conserved charges, but by the dipole charges. And all three dipole charges will feed into this. Yeah. So the all three dipole charges will feed in. So what does this look like? Well, this is the geometry. So if you try to give an ADS CFT description, it looks like in the UV here, you have one CFT, because there's an ADS structure there. In the infrared, you have another CFT, but set with a, well, but the central charges of the two CFT are going to be different because the sizes of the ADS space is different in the two cases. And what one can check is that the central charge in the infrared is indeed smaller than in the UV. So what does this seem to say? Well, it looks like this is a gravity dual of an RG flow from one CFT to another one. So the idea is that you have a CFT in the ultraviolet, you do something to it that induces a flow, and then you flow down into the infrared and find another CFT, which is determined by the dipole charges. So what you do to the ultraviolet theory has to have something to do with the dipole charges, which is pretty clear, because in the BMPV case, you had no dipole charges, so there was no flow. But precisely how is the flow induced?
Can't be read off just from the asymptotic form of the metric.
You might. Yes. That's the idea, that you should be able to take the leading order to the asymptotics and then try to read off what's going on. So, in other cases where people have studied gravity duals of RG flows, they have known precisely what was going on in the field theory side, then constructed the geometry and then compared various aspects to see that it really matched what they expected. But in this case, we don't actually know too much about the field theory. I mean, there's been lots of studies, but it's not precisely clear what can induce this kind of flow. I don't think there's been any study of that. But the funny part here would then be to reconstruct that whole story just because we know an exact solution on the gravity side. Should be able to infer that. But it's just, I don't think anybody, well, nobody has done it. Yet.
I think it's clear it's not a flow induced by deforming the CFT.
By the what?
It's not the flow isn't induced by deforming the UV CFT.
No, but that's something that still has to be checked explicitly.
Wait, so it's not just adding a term to the
result? No, I don't think so. No. That would have been a peculiar asymptotics for the fields in ADS3. So it seems more like you're turning on a bed in the CFT.
That's one option, yeah, that you can do it. Okay, so this is one of the interesting questions that there hasn't been done really any work on yet. Okay, so now I wanted to move on to the non-supersymmetric black rings. So the idea is the following. If you have the supersymmetric black ring and then kick in a little bit of energy, you should find a non-supersymmetric solution. So since the solutions we start out with, the supersymmetric ones, have 7 independent parameters, when you add some energy, you should at least have 8 independent parameters. But you could also imagine that you should be able to vary all 3 dipole charges independently. So what you might expect is to find a 9-parameter family of solutions. But we haven't found such a solution yet. The best we can do, and this is done in this last paper here, is a 7-parameter is a 7-parameter family of solutions. So what these solutions are characterized by are 6 conserved charges. Which are 3 net charges, 2 angular momenta, as well as the mass above extremality. So of course this leaves a run parameter, well, a 1-fold non-uniqueness. If you take these solutions, this class of solutions, and then take the energy of above extremality to 0. Then you end up, well, I should start, of course, these solutions here have 3 charges, but they also have 3 dipoles. Now, if you take the supersymmetric limit of these solutions, what you end up with is a free charge, 2-dipole supersymmetric ring. It's not a black ring because it doesn't have a horizon. So it's a singular ring. So what you might hope to do with this is if you understand if you understand what is the brain system of this free charge 2-dipole super tube, then what happens when you add a little bit of energy to it, is it then possible to reproduce the near extremal black ring entropy just from the microscopic point of view? And again, that's one thing that hasn't been done at all. Of course, what we need is the more general solution with 9 parameters. But it's a there are many steps in trying to find this, and the first one hasn't been completed yet. So there's still a way to go. There's one other thing that is interesting to look at. We find these solutions, well, there's the supergravity solution describing this free charge 2-dipole supertube. Likewise, a long time ago it was found the 2-charge 1-dipole black ring, well, not black, supertube. So, well, these are just supposed to be singular rings. What you can ask then is, what parameters of these solutions is it possible to add energy and get a black object? So you might think of this as a criterion for this being a good singularity, that once you add energy, you go away from extremality, you go away from the supersymmetric limit, then you actually get a black object with a regular horizon. And we find some interesting structure here. First of all, it's interesting to note that from the whirl volume analysis of these 2-charge 1-dipole supertubes, there's a bound on the angular momentum of the object. I should mention that this ring only has 1 angular momentum, that doesn't have a second angular momentum. There's an upper bound set on that angular momentum by the 2 charges it carries and the dipole. This just comes out of the whirl volume analysis. Now, when you look at the supergravity solution, which is supposed to be this object once you include the back reaction and the geometry, then you find precisely the same bound, but it comes from requiring that you don't have any causal pathologies, in the sense that you don't have any closed time-like curves near the object. So that's something typically happening for rotating objects, that closed time-like curves develop near the object in case it's rotating too fast. So this is what this bound says. Now furthermore, if we try to go non-extremal, so non-BPS, then we find that it's only possible to get a regular black hole with two charges and one dipole, this is a black ring, in the case where this bound is obeyed. So it's a coincidence of three bounds, which is very nice. It's just very physical. It comes out this way. So the question is if there's something similar going on for the free charge two dipole system.
So yeah. The statement about non-BPS, is that also to avoid closed time-like curves? I mean,
no. This is, you can violate the bound, but then you get conical singularities to balance the object.
All right. So in the non-BPS case, it's to avoid conical singularities that you get the bound.
Yes, once you get a proper horizon, and you add energy and get a proper horizon, you can only go away from the super, well, to say it in a different way, if you look at all the solutions that are regular black rings with two charges and one dipole, and try to take the supersymmetric limit, you precisely pick out the supersymmetric solutions that obey this bound. Unless you admit for conical singularities. Okay. So, in the free charge two dipole case, we have the world volume description by Binner and Krauss, but it didn't capture the second angle momentum. So this one has actually two angle momentum. So we can't really say what the bound is. The closest thing you can get is, let me say what it is in a second. Let me say what the supergravity condition is, because we know the exact supergravity solution for this. And again, to avoid closed time-like curves near the object, you need the following bound to hold. So I've imagined that in the full solution I described with three dipole charges, I've set the third dipole charge to zero. Then you find that this bound has to hold to avoid closed time-like curves. The best you can get in the world volume description is something that involves just one angle momentum, but you can't reproduce this term either, the product of the two dipole charges. So there's a mismatch between the world volume description and the supergravity description. However, there's a match precisely between the supergravity condition of avoiding closed time-like curves and the condition for adding energy. That gives precisely the same bound. Okay. So I'll end by saying some concluding remarks and pointing out some outlook. So first, for non-supersymmetric black rings, we need a more general solution. And if we can find that, then it'll be interesting to try to reproduce near-extremal, near-supersymmetric entropy from string theory. Secondly, for the non-supersymmetric black rings, that the new first law is to explore. And this more general solution will definitely be a nice testing lab for the results that Keith and Gary are finding for first laws. Okay, so I mentioned already entropy from the microscopic point of view. And then there's another question, which is the stability of these objects away from the supersymmetric limit. And this even, I mean, this also comes down to just completely neutral black rings, five dimensions. So for the supersymmetric rings, in connection to the entropy, I mentioned the mystery of this second angle momentum. There are also another question, which is, what roles do black rings play in Mathieu's conjecture? So first, it looked like that Mathieu had to find all the microstates corresponding to a BMPV black hole. It now looks like he also has to find the ones corresponding to a black ring, or to somehow explain how that this averaging process of microstates on the gravity side can give different black rings with the same conserved charges. Then there's the RG flow, which would be nice to understand, which might clear up some of the questions of the entropy calculations too. And finally, there's a new connection between four-dimensional black holes and five-dimensional black holes, particular black rings. And that's what Harvey's going to talk about next Thursday. Yes. Thank you.
So when these bounds are saturated, can you trust the world volume computations, or would there be some back reaction from the geometry?
You mean these bounds here?
Yeah.
What you actually find is, on the gravity side, when these bounds are saturated, then the solutions are not singular. So in the two charge one dipole case, when you precisely saturate this bound, what used to be a curvature singularity now has become a completely smooth geometry.
But that's a case where both computations agree, right?
Well, yes. In the other case here, I don't know. No, there shouldn't be any reason why it shouldn't. We haven't checked that if this bound is saturated, that you actually get a perfectly smooth solution, just like you do in the two charge one dipole case. But there's no reason not to trust either of the descriptions.
So when you say smooth, then it's without horizons?
Yeah. So these two cases, the only cases that have horizons and are supersymmetric are the ones with three charges and three dipoles. So if you set one of the dipoles to zero, you end up in this case and you have a singular ring in general.
You get topology changes in this?
No, you can just see that if you take the limit where the third dipole goes to zero, then the S2 size of the horizon shrinks down to zero.
Right, so is there a topology change?
No, that's not a... Oh, you mean in the full geometry?
Yeah, the full geometry.
Ah.
It's not flat space. Is there some range replaced by flats or something like that?
That might be possible. I'm not sure. But the picture that you would have is in the case... This is the case where you have the D1, D5... momentum picture, and what typically happens is that the Kaluza-Klein monopole is what saves you, that makes things shrink off in a smooth way. That might be possible. I haven't checked. I haven't seen that.
Okay.
So you just say, when you saturate this bound, just say for the two charged one dipole case, there's no singularity, you just get this curve of Clute's prime monopoles.
Yeah.
So now you just add a little bit of mass, you get a horizon surrounding that.
But that's tricky. What is tricky is that precisely when you saturate the bound, you need to add more energy in order to get a horizon.
So, basket?
Well, I think that may be a bit too strong to say, but you need, what we see in the solutions is that if you start with the bound exactly saturated, then we don't know how to go away from it.
Oh.
Unless you just go a tiny, tiny bit away, then we can go supersymmetric. Well, you can go non-supersymmetrically away from it.
Oh, I see. So if J is a little bit less, you have non-supersymmetric solutions. But when J is actually equal to that, you don't have any non-symmetric.
Yeah. But there's this effective picture of it in terms of effective strings, that you think of the D1, D5 system as one long effective string. And then the longer it is, the cheaper it is to excite modes on it. Now, the case where you precisely saturate this bound, all these effective strings are singly wound, and everything is very expensive to excite. So that's the effective picture why it might be hard to go non-extremal in the case where the bound is saturated. But we don't, and there's no proof that this is correct. So.
Is that convenient?